Personally and professionally, he embodies the principles of which Northern Trust was founded on: service, expertise, integrity, and community. Since our beginning, we have seen this through Rick, and you saw in his bio the many, many committees, boards that he serves on and in many cases leads. He serves also as the board member for the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, Chicago Urban League, and the International Monetary Conference. This will make him uniquely suited today to discuss the role leverage plays in the economy and financial system. On a personal note, I can also tell you, Rick is a great, great golfer and a huge sports enthusiast. Yes, we've had some bets on on some hockey teams and some baseball teams, and I've lost. But he's been a gracious winner on that. Bottom line, though, you want to see him smile? Ask about Emily, his granddaughter of 1 year. It is with great pleasure that I introduce to you the chairman and CEO of Northern Trust, Rick Waddell.
Thank you, Stephanie. And wow, what a pleasure to be here. This is extraordinarily kind of you to extend an invitation for me to come down and talk. I hope what I have to say is, I guess I can get rid of that, right? Is worthy. Just a couple of comments. To the students here from Marco Island Academy and Gulf Coast High School, you guys and girls are extraordinarily impressive, and I think we should all give another round of applause. Sometimes I say I couldn't get into the college I went into. I'm not sure I could get into the high school these folks go to. You're really impressive, and I will say I want you to pay particular attention to what I'm going to talk about, because you're going to inherit the tab. So just pay attention. Mel, thank you, and the whole board for your gracious hospitality inviting me down here. It's been wonderful, and I'm really honored to be here. I also have to note that I've got to be a little careful of what I'm going to say, first of all, because there are so many friends. Obviously, a number of clients of the bank are here, and we're grateful for you to be here and for your relationship with the bank. But we have many, many friends, Kate and I, she couldn't be here, but are here today. And just want you to know that when you're back in Chicago, you know, come see us. We'd love to keep in touch. And thank you for having me down here. But the most important thing is my boss is here. Now, that would be John Rowe, who is the lead independent director of the Northern Trust. John, I have to say, I was going to say something about how honored I am that so many of you wore ties to this luncheon, but John didn't wear a tie. So I don't know if I'm in trouble because of that, or John, it's great to be here, and I think you're going to hear a couple of things that you know are of concern to me. And as Stephanie said, I want to talk about debt. I want to talk about leverage. I'm going to talk a little bit about the great financial crisis. I became the CEO of Northern Trust on January 1, 2008, so I have a little bit of experience with this subject. But I want to talk about the role of debt as it led into the 2008 financial crisis. I'm going to talk about the structural changes in the economy and the financial system that we've experienced in the recovery, and how that has actually, I think, benefited in many ways our ability to withstand another financial crisis. I am going to talk about the tremendous, and I mean tremendous, public debt and unfunded liabilities that, in my view, is really the next crisis that we're waiting to see unfold. Now, when I came to the bank in 1975, I was trained as a banker. So balance sheets and income statements mean a lot to me, and I love, as a banker, numbers. And I'm going to talk, I'm going to give you a lot of numbers. These are numbers that either, I won't be talking about millions, I'll be talking about billions and trillions of dollars. So just remember the size and context of what I'm going to talk about. First, though, I think it would be helpful to put in context the role that debt plays in any modern economy. Debt is a form of capital, and it facilitates investments for individuals, firms, and governments. It encourages economic growth as a relatively cheap financing source, cheap versus the cost of equity, for many consumers and businesses. And I think it's rather interesting that our president-elect has a love affair with debt, so maybe he should pay attention to what I'm going to say. Debt is also an important and permanent element of public finance in modern economies. For example, two of the most powerful and advanced economies in the world, the United States and the United Kingdom, have been in debt for literally hundreds of years. Many of you, who's been to Hamilton, seen Hamilton? So you know that this great musical, which is about the life and times of our first Treasury Secretary when Alexander Hamilton consolidated our nascent nation's debt, which back in those days totaled a grand total of $75 million, was the first Treasury issuance when Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury. The first big number I'll give you, today's debt on the books of the U.S. government are approaching $20 trillion. So I'm going to come back to that. Debt comes in three forms, as the way I look at it. There's public debt, so issued by governments and government-sponsored entities. Private debt, so consumers and companies take out bank loans, issue corporate bonds, and the like. A third element that I think is what I'm going to lead up to in the end are entitlement programs, both public and private. These include pensions, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and other similar programs. Some of these programs are funded or partially funded, meaning there are assets to support these the liabilities, but most of these are not funded. Despite Shakespeare's admonition to neither a borrower nor lender be, without debt, fewer people would own homes, it would be harder for entrepreneurs to turn their ideas into businesses, and governments would have much less flexibility in their spending. There is a myth that economies with no debt would be the healthiest economy on a competitive basis. But I think the opposite is true. As long as debt levels are manageable, too much debt, as we saw in the global financial crisis, can cause serious problems. So let me talk about the financial crisis and what led up to in 2008 when we experienced a significant increase in consumer and mortgage debt. I want to put that buildup into context for you. So let's first of all look at mortgages. In 1998, 10 years before the crisis, total U.S. mortgage debt was $5.3 trillion. That's about 57% of the GDP, the gross domestic product of the entire United States economy at that time, a little bit less than 60%. 5 years later, the balance of mortgages in the United States was $8.9 trillion, or 78%. Of GDP. And at the peak of the crisis, total U.S. mortgages had increased to $14.8 trillion. That was measured in the second quarter of 2008, which was the peak. And that's about 100% of GDP at the time, which tells you that the total mortgage debt on the books of consumers, owed by consumers, equaled the total output of the U.S. economy at that time, about 100%. Now, on top of the mortgages that everybody had taken out, there was more consumer debt, car loans, credit cards, etc. That peaked in 2008 at $2.7 trillion. Now, again, being a banker, and I was trained by Lloyd Liggett and Tuck Tyler here to be a banker, if you have debt, you're very interested in the ability to service that debt. So in 2008, U.S. household incomes, the debt to income, so the debt over the amount of income totaled 130%. So we all, as an economy, owed more by 30% than what we were making, which is an all-time high at that time. Now, this unsustainable environment was facilitated to the point of collapse by six key factors. First, U.S. housing policy. Initiatives by the U.S. government to expand home ownership gave credit access to many, many people, many who didn't deserve it, including subprime borrowers through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'll tell you the first time that I ever heard the phrase or read the phrase subprime borrower was in March of 2007 when I picked up the Wall Street Journal, and on the front page was HSBC, which had acquired in Chicago a firm by the name of Household Finance. And in the first quarter of 2007, HSBC took a charge related to the household finance investment of $11 billion. And I'm reading this article, and it goes through, and it's talking about household that had made a lot of loans. Household was a finance company when I knew them. But they had made a lot of loans to subprime. They had made subprime loans. And I'm reading this, and I say, what the heck is a subprime loan? So I call our bankers. I said, do we have subprime loans? And they say, what is it? I said, well, those are loans to people who are subprime. I mean, we wouldn't lend to them. And really, that was literally the first time that I had heard of the phrase subprime. These housing policies created a significant amount of new credit, mortgage credit, and it began to erode lending standards across the board, and it had the unintended consequence of encouraging speculative behavior in the housing markets. The government's implicit support of Fannie and Freddie helped encourage mortgage-backed security demand at very relatively low yields, plus other policies such as the deductibility of property taxes and mortgage interest, as well as loan programs offered through entities like the FHA and VA, encouraged many, many consumers to buy instead of rent. And you know, one of the things about banking is the problem with making loans is either people pay them back, they roll them over, or they get charged off. But in almost all those cases, when they get charged off or they get paid back, you've got to run out and get another loan to create that earning asset. So there was this spiral of increasing credit to keep the engine going. And that leads me to the second issue that I think fueled this crisis, and that was the financial business model that was predominant at the time. Many lenders used an originate-to-sell model, which meant that as soon as they created an asset, a mortgage, they sold it into the securitized mortgage-backed market, and they created other similar debt instruments. Since the banks weren't assuming any risk because they didn't put them on their balance sheet, this gave them a huge incentive to underprice the risk. So by the time the loans were bundled and sold, many investors didn't understand the risks that they had assumed. I'm going to give you an example of that in a minute. Also, many lenders relied on short-term funding, like commercial paper, which meant they had to regularly access the debt markets, sometimes on a weekly or overnight basis, to fuel the creation of these assets. This proved disastrous for many banks when the liquidity in those markets dried up and they could no longer fund themselves and were forced to sell assets on a fire sale basis. And we know that in 2008, Lehman Brothers was 66% funded by overnight wholesale deposits. And the lesson in one of the lessons in all of this is that in the U.S. banking system, there was actually quite a lot of capital, but it's always liquidity that takes a bank down. It's a run on the bank, And that is what we saw in 2008. Now, there was not only the regulated banking industry where this was all happening, but there was the shadow banking industry. And those firms in the shadow banking, which were other finance company, lightly regulated entities, were engaging in the same creation of assets and funding them with short-term deposits. And that exacerbated the business model situation. The third area was the state of regulation in the financial markets. Many regulations were focused either on the wrong activities or the wrong entities, so they didn't effectively address the real risks that were building in the system. For example, many lenders, including in particular the European banks, were not required to hold enough loss-absorbing capital. Poorly constructed capital rules allowed risk to build up in the shadow banking system, as I mentioned. Also, the balkanization of oversight of the regulatory environment. And today, I can tell you, Northern Trust, I would argue, a relatively conservative business model, is overseen by 50 different regulators on a global basis. And back then, this balkanization allowed many companies to exploit the weaker points in the system to evade regulation. That was a real problem. Regulators also didn't address the heavy reliance on short-term funding, as I said, and the importance of liquidity in terms of solvency. And finally, despite the fact that the Federal Reserve had the power to establish minimum mortgage underwriting standards and to examine the securitization practices of these originate-to-sell banks, the Fed did not exercise that power. So they were at the table as well. Fourth reason, interest rates. Very low interest rates, partially a holdover from the burst of the 2000 dot-com bubble, encouraged investors from all over the world to look for yield. Does that sound familiar? We've been in a very low interest rate environment now for about 9 years, searching for yield, and the Fed's been trying to get everybody to get into riskier assets to create it, so beware. This channeled more money to fuel asset bubbles in the U.S. housing market as well as in other countries like Ireland and Spain. Their housing markets were decimated. The next issue was the over-reliance on credit rating agencies. Because of the complexity of the mortgage-backed securities underwritten by the originate-to-sell lenders, many investors relied on credit rating agencies rather than doing their own due diligence on these securitized instruments. In many cases, the models the agencies used did not accurately capture the risks in these securities, resulting in, guess what, investor losses. Let me give you one example. I got this out of an article in, I think it was Forbes or Fortune, but they actually deconstructed one of these mortgage-backed securities that were issued in the crisis. It was a security that was issued in 2006. This security was composed of 8,274 different mortgages bundled together. These are the credit characteristics of those 8,274 mortgages. The average equity in those mortgages was 0.71%. When my wife and I borrowed from the Northern Trust for our first home, we had to put down 30%, 0.71%. 58% of those mortgages were to no low documentation mortgages, borrowers, meaning the creditworthiness of the borrowers were not properly verified. And in this one security of 8,274 mortgages, all the mortgages were second mortgages, which means that there was a first mortgage before it, and then the lender made a second mortgage, and it was those second mortgages that were packaged together. So I think we can all agree that doesn't sound like a safe investment. Once the loans were packaged together, the risk was sliced and diced by our friends on Wall Street into what are called different tranches. 68% of, I think there were 13 tranches, 68% of the value in those tranches was rated AAA by Moody's and S&P. 25% of the issue was rated between AA and BBB minus. BBB minus is the lowest investment grade rating you can get. So the implication was that these are all, you know, pretty good securities. So what happened? 93% of this one issue was rated investment grade, and every investor lost in that in those securities. 91% loss in the A1 and A2 tranches, which were AAA rated. So those AAA rated investors lost over 90% of their principal. So that was what was going on, and that was just one. And there, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how much of this was issued at the time. But the final point I want to make about the causes leading up to the crisis was the interconnectedness of the global financial system. And this interconnectedness allowed capital from all over the world to flow into these overheating sectors like the U.S. housing market. And once the crisis commenced, this integration allowed the contagion to spread rapidly around the world. One example, in the over-the-counter derivatives, which are essentially synthetic assets and liabilities, this created significant leverage in the system. And one measure of the level of these derivative over-the-counter derivatives is something called the net current credit exposure, which the regulators use as a benchmark to measure the exposure of derivatives in the system. In the fourth quarter of 2008, that number, the net current credit exposure, which was the net of these derivatives, totaled over $800 billion. Just 1 year before, that number had been $200 billion. So it four times larger in less than a year. All of these six factors worked in concert to create a highly leveraged environment that eventually reached a breaking point in 2008. As investors began to panic, they rushed to sell risky assets, but found few willing buyers. This depressed the asset prices even further, and in particular affected a number of institutions with significant risk exposures. We all know them: Bear Stearns, Countrywide, Wachovia, IndyMac, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and culminated in the failures of AIG and Lehman Brothers towards the end of September 2008. As I said, the financial panic spread quickly around the globe, and it reverberated, obviously, into the real economy as people lost their homes, their jobs, and their savings. Between 2007 and 2009, which was the peak to the trough, in the U.S., 8.8 million jobs were lost, and $19.2 trillion of household wealth was erased. Huge, huge impact. As I said, that was my first year as the CEO. I was glad I'm the CEO at Northern Trust and not one of our competitors. And there's been a lot written about the financial crisis and how it's impacted our economy, but I really want to turn now, if I might, to the recovery and what has changed in the world to hopefully prevent what happened. As the recovery enters the ninth year, the overall net effect of the changes to our economy, financial markets, and the regulatory environment has been to create, in my opinion, a more resilient system that is better equipped to handle future downturns. Since 2008, we have seen debt levels creep up in parts of the economy, but because of the improvements I'm going to talk about, I remain cautiously optimistic about the U.S. economy's strength and future prospects. Let me talk about a couple of big improvements. First, the market structure. There have been a number of positive changes to the structure of our markets. Let me highlight just a couple of them. First, the move away from the originate-to-sell business model has decreased residential mortgage securitization and created better incentives for market participants to appropriately price risk. Non-agency residential mortgage security market has essentially evaporated. So the MBS security I described a little while ago, that doesn't happen anymore. 2015, the issuance of mortgage-backed securities was only $13.7 billion. In 2001, going back over a decade, it was well over $200 billion. So that market has changed. Now, nearly all mortgages are either securitized through governmental agencies like Fannie and Freddie, which are held to strict underwriting standards, or they're held on the balance sheet of the lenders. You might hear the concept skin in the game. Banks are now required to hold part of that risk. They can still sell a loan, but they have to hold, I think, 10 or 15% of that loan on their balance sheet, which I think is an extraordinarily good thing. I will tell you, Northern Trust has never sold our, every loan we make sits on our balance sheet, so we don't have that issue. Many of you have probably experienced the increased underwriting standards when you apply for a mortgage. And for those you young folks that are going to be in the mortgage market in 5 or 10 years, get ready to sign a lot of documents. For example, I mentioned earlier, verification of employment, bank account balances, and 2 years of tax returns are always required to get a loan. That's in sharp contrast to what were called the ninja loans. Do you remember ninja loans? No income, no job, and no assets. That's what we were doing at the height of the crisis. Many of the mortgage products that help fuel the bubble are no longer available, such as interest-only loans or not available at all, like option ARMs. Shadow banking activity has also decreased substantially. And perhaps more importantly, what activity remains relies on much more stable funding sources. So this idea that you're going to make long-term loans and fund them with short-term deposits is really pretty much over. These changes in bank business practices have significantly reduced the risk in the system. At the same time, increased regulatory scrutiny has helped firms and regulators alike better understand and address the risks in our financial system. Those Northern Trust partners who are here today, please raise your hand. You've heard me talk ad nauseum about the regulatory costs that we're dealing with, and they're real. I'm actually going to say something good about the regulatory environment for the industry. We have all seen a huge amount of significant new regulatory initiatives post-crisis. And from the banking industry perspective, the Dodd-Frank Act and the Federal Reserve Comprehensive Capital Analysis and Review Process, otherwise known as CCAR, have had the most important impact. Regulatory changes have resulted in increased capitalization levels across the financial industry, making banks much better prepared to absorb losses. For example, a common ratio that we all pay attention to is Tier 1 capital for U.S. banks. That was approximately 9% for the U.S. banking system in 2007. Today, that's nearly 14%. So there's much, much more capital in the U.S. banking system than there was in the crisis. Banks are also now required to regularly conduct stress tests to quantify the expected impact of market stress events over their businesses. That's what we call CCAR. Large institutions are also required to submit a resolution plan or a living will to demonstrate how they would wind down their bank in the event of failure, with the goal of minimizing the impact on taxpayers. While these regulations aren't perfect, and as I implied, they're hugely costly, very costly, they have undoubtedly increased the strength of the U.S. banking sector and have required management teams in the industry to focus more on the risks inherent in their businesses. And I have to say, even at Northern Trust, we have learned a couple of things about the complexity of our global business as a result of things like CCAR, which have been instructive. So what I'd like to do now is just conclude with, and this is, I don't want to be totally negative, but I want to talk about where we are on the leverage front and where I see some potential issues looming. As I said, while leverage has decreased markedly following the crisis, we have witnessed a recent buildup in certain parts of the economy. Let me look at the three categories I mentioned before. Government debt. federal debt has increased significantly since the crisis, in part tied to the government's involvement in the recovery. Total federal debt was 63% of GDP in December 2007, but it has ballooned to 105% of GDP as of the middle of this year. And the only time that ratio was higher was in World War II. According to the usdebtclock.org, if you want to go to a very interesting app, pull up usdebtclock.org, and you'll see real-time debt on virtually every way you want to slice and dice it. It's kind of scary. According to the usdebtclock.org, in the time I've been talking, the U.S. government has incurred an additional $7 million in outstanding debt. Now, private debt has also been increasing, as I said, but not at the same pace in all sectors. Household debt grew at a pace of 3% from 2007 to 2014, much slower than the 8.5% increase from 2000 to 2007. Total mortgage debt was $10.1 trillion in the second quarter of 2016, down from the $14.8 trillion I mentioned that existed in 2008. On the other hand, total consumer debt, excluding mortgages, was $3.7 trillion just this past September, well above the $2.7 trillion that existed in 2008. However, the ability to service that debt, U.S. debt-to-income ratios, are approximately 100%. Remember, that number was 130% at the crisis. It's down to 100% now. So the ability of borrowers to service the debt is better. Finally, let me conclude with some comments about the debt or the liabilities associated with entitlements. While not a direct cause of the financial crisis, unfunded liabilities, both public and private, continue to be a persistent long-term problem that we must address. In 1999, private pension plans were 127% funded, meaning there was $1.27 in assets for every dollar of liability. Okay? By the end of 2015, that ratio had dropped to 81%, so only 81 cents in assets to support a dollar of future liabilities. To give you a sense of the magnitude on the private pensions, that number for the S&P 500 of unfunded pension liabilities in 2015 was $403 billion. Now, that's partly due to the fact that interest rates were extraordinarily low, and there's an inverse. As rates go down, liabilities go up, and as rates go up, that number will come down. But unfunded pension liabilities, big issue. At the state and local government level, a recent Stanford University report estimates that unfunded pension liabilities, now we're moving from private to state and local governments, $1.2 trillion of unfunded pension obligations at state and local governments. That's about equal to 7% of the U.S. economy, GDP. As you might expect, some states are in better shape than others. Just to pick on Florida here, if looking at that number on a per capita basis, the pensions in Florida are 91% funded, so not well above the average of 81, not 100. You'd like it to be 100 or more. In Illinois, where I live, some of you have homes there and may be citizens, that number is 41% funded. Okay? Recent Cato Institute report measured total funded debt, unfunded pension liabilities, and other post-employment benefits, health care, etc., on a per capita base, so I'm bringing this number down to what it means for each citizen, what that debt is per citizen, the results are striking. Here in Illinois, in Florida, everybody in the state of Illinois, Florida, owes, if you look at this total debt, $9,082. That's the amount of debt burden you all carry in the state of Illinois. Florida. That is backwards. In Illinois, it's $28,000. So every citizen of the state of Illinois owns $28,000 to support these liabilities. Let me move to the federal level. Here the numbers are truly staggering. Let me break it down for you. As I said earlier, the total amount of U.S. government debt is a little bit less than $20 trillion. So that's treasuries and notes and bonds and real debt that the government issues. The liabilities associated, unfunded liabilities associated with Social Security, $15.5 trillion. Medicare, unfunded liabilities, $27 trillion. And if you add up all of the federal, state, and local funded and unfunded liabilities, it exceeds $100 trillion. And that's relatively conservative. There are estimates out there, depending upon the kind of accounting that you want to use, that get upwards of $200 trillion. And remember, the U.S. economy is, the GDP is running at about $20 trillion, $18-19 trillion a year. And we've got these liabilities out there in all these areas. And I just say one other little thing that is kind of in the news recently. Pay attention to it, I think, especially those of you going to college and are going to take on some student debt. Student debt, I'll say, and basically the government now is the only lender in the market for student debt. $1.2 trillion, total amount of student debt that's out there. Just last week, the administration announced a plan to begin forgiving that debt. And over the next several years, the call on the U.S. government budget will be in excess of $800 billion to essentially wipe off a good chunk of that student debt. So now, you know, governments, as I said, borrow cheaply. They can raise taxes. There's a whole way of dealing with this. Growth is one that we all hope, you know, we see. I was reading one interesting analyst that said the way to... How am I doing time-wise? Not too well. Here's just one way. This is to solve this problem, let's call it a $100 billion problem, you'd have to raise income taxes 17%, raise payroll taxes 24%, cut government purchases by 26%, and cut Social Security and Medicare benefits by 11%. So big, big problem. I'm going to kind of skip over. Illinois is the poster child for the problems that the United States faces. Our structural budget deficit in Illinois is $3 to $4 billion every year. We have $10 billion of unpaid back bills that the government has no ability to pay, and they keep pushing folks off. And the unfunded pension liabilities in Illinois, it's estimated by the middle of 2017, will approach $140 billion. Now, I don't want to be all gloom and doom. I actually think some of the changes that we've as a result of the election, I'm not going to go there, but I was in Washington last week, and the change in Washington is palpable. I think we're going to get corporate tax reform. That will be a hugely positive thing for business in the United States. I think we're going to get an infrastructure spending bill, and as long as it's not just shovel-ready but actually productive and produces efficiencies in the economy, that will be very good. And I do believe that there will be some level of deregulation that will, and I don't mean just about the banks, and we would love it. My view is if they just stop giving us new stuff to deal with and gave us a couple of year breather, we'd be fine. We'd absolutely be fine. But you think about the small business and all the environmental, we're going to get some relief from that, and I think that sets the table for a really, really strong U.S. economy. We are the largest, most resilient, deepest economy in the world. There's a lot of hope that I have for better days ahead, but I'm telling you, this unfunded debt that is out there in the public sector, the next crisis I don't think is going to be in the financial markets. It's going to be whether a state can really roll their debt over or meet the pension obligations, promises that they've made to a lot of very important workers. So with that, I'm going to conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick. We have some beautiful cocktail table books for you to take back to Kate to show her what she's missed in a beautiful day here in Florida. We covered a lot of the questions, so I'm just going to cut to one that was asked repeatedly, which was, do you think that Trump will try to get rid of Dodd-Frank? And just some comments about Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, I don't think, as I just said, I don't think they'll get rid of Dodd-Frank. I think that would be a waste of political capital in my mind. I think there are some tweaks to Dodd-Frank. I'll give you one example that even the regulators, when I was in Washington last week, agreed. In Dodd-Frank, there's something called DFAST, which is the Dodd-Frank Act stress test, DFAST. That is a mid-year stress test that we all have to do. So there's CCAR, which is the annual stress test, and literally the next day we submit those stress test results in April. We immediately, our team begins working in the middle of April on DFAST, and we have to push the button on DFAST in September. The Fed has told us, the board has told us, they don't even look at the results of DFAST. And we say, well, why do you make us do it? And they correctly point out that they don't make us do it. It's actually written in the law. So they say, go to Congress and get it fixed. I think that'll get fixed. That's the kind of thing that I think we could, and that, without, I will disavow, that costs us $2 or $3 million a year to do DFAST. And so if you spread that across all of the banks, and you know, and we're just a little old Northern. I mean, I can't imagine what the bigger banks have to deal with. That's the kind of relief I think we're looking for.
And then finally, one final question. Discuss the short and long-term ramifications of the Trump effect.
the Trump bump? I call it the Trump bump. I think the Trump bump is becoming the Trump ramp. It's got more legs than, if you're talking about the market, I think it's got some strength. As I said, I think the U.S. economy is going to do well. And we shouldn't forget the improvement in the U.S. economy up to now, which, you know, in terms of unemployment being below 5%, the Fed's focus on inflation, it's actually starting to ratchet up a little bit. We're starting to see some wage pressure. Those are all indicators of an improving economy. And if you take that improvement and you put on top of it some saner regulatory and infrastructure and tax relief, I think this thing can get going. Now, there's a risk, and we know what the risk is. He tweets a lot, and you know, there I'm sure there are other videos, and who knows what might derail this thing. I think we talked about a little bit. I personally think he's got a pretty good cabinet. He's surrounding himself with people who are knowledgeable and sane and may not disagree with everything, but I will tell you, it's palpable the change, the attitude in Washington to get some things done that will be very, very positive. So I'm hopeful.
Right. Thank you very much, Rick.